I next met with Dr. Nair Rizvi, and to begin, we chatted about immunotherapy of non-small cell lung cancer, and Dr. Rizvi provided an overview of where we've been and where we are now.
I think the predictors of response are becoming increasingly helpful. I think that smoking history is emerging as somewhat of a useful predictor. I think that the main predictor that we're trying to understand is the expression of PD-L1. The assay for PD-L1 is basically an immunohistochemical assay to look at expression of PD-L1, membranous PD-L1 expression, primarily on tumor. And the notion is that if you have high levels of PD-L1, that means that you have a lot of inhibition of T cells within that tumor microenvironment, so that may correlate with how dependent that tumor is on PD-1 inhibition.
Any sense, because, you know, obviously people have been reported who respond who don't have the PD-L1, any sense about whether or not how much of this might be the way the assay is being done or the type of assay? Do you think ultimately this might be a very accurate predictor or more accurate?
I think that the assays, you know, across vendors is overall similar. I don't think that there's one unique assay which is so different that it's better than the other. I think the main issue, the main limitation is probably there's more to the story than just the PD-L1. Also, the assay is affected by what potentially the prior therapies are. So it seems clear that if you have a more recent tumor biopsy to look for PD-L1 expression, that correlates better with response than if you use a more remote archived specimen. I also think that there's got to be some sampling issue. You know, when you've got a tumor and you're putting a small, even if it's a core, it's a small part of the tumor, and whether that represents other parts of that same tumor or whether that represents other areas of metastases, it's not a binary result like EGFR mutation where either you have it or you don't. It's really a spectrum and can be affected by a lot of variables. So I think it's going to be useful, frankly, in terms of thinking about immune checkpoint inhibitors and what line of therapy to give it in. I think that if you are giving it in first line treatment for lung cancer, you know, the bar is higher because the patients are more chemo responsive. And I think you want to enrich for likelihood of response. And I think that certainly the first line data that was presented with pembrolizumab was very favorable in terms of response rate as first line therapy with pembrolizumab in PD-L1 positive patients. So I think that both pembrolizumab and nivolumab are being studied in phase 3 randomized trials as first line therapy in PD-L1 positive patients. I think when you move to the second line setting, where chemotherapy response rates are in the sort of 10% range, or if you move to third line therapy where activity is even lower, I think that the requirement for PD-L1 positivity will be less, because I think that if you have a comparable response rate or potentially even a better response rate in the second or third line therapy, and even if you're PD-L1 negative, I think that, you know, there'd be a lot of interest to use these drugs. The other difference between these drugs than, you know, standard chemotherapy or even targeted therapy if you have an EGFR mutation is that we do see a tail on these curves, and so we have patients who have these responses and they're durable. It's much more difficult to develop resistance to immunotherapy than with chemotherapy or targeted therapy. So, you know, we are seeing longer-term durable benefit in that subset of patients that have a response.
Sort of globally with these agents, what do you see in terms of the timing of response? When does it occur? Do you see, or how often do you see this sort of pseudo-progression where it looks like on imaging things are getting worse, but they're actually about to get better? What's the paradigm for, you know, evaluating response with these agents?
Right. So I think certainly with CTLA-4 and melanoma, because it's more priming of T cells, takes time to turn them on, time to get them to go to the tumor and to work, you know, the responses can take longer and can often be more delayed. You know, in lung cancer, as we talked about, I mean, for the patients that respond, you know, those T cells are sitting on the tumor and they just need to be turned on. And so for the most part, we are seeing responses within the first imaging time point and potentially even sooner. I think one of the first patients I treated, he had a painful adrenal mass that was quite uncomfortable. And after his first dose of treatment, he woke up the next day and he had no pain whatsoever. And he was treated for 2 years on the phase one nivolumab program, and now he's actually been off treatment for a year and continues to have really no evidence of cancer. So the initial phase one program was really for 2 years only, the therapy, and then you stop therapy. And that comes to another question, is how long to give these drugs. And I think that that's kind of a work in progress. Is, you know, if you're turning on the T cells and you have memory T cells, do you really need to continue these therapies indefinitely?
Globally, with these agents, how many patients actually get to the point where they can get off therapy after, say, 2 years?
I think that the different trials that we're part of, you know, have different durations of therapy. So, you know, some are a year, some are indefinite, some are 2 years. So I think it's a difficult question to answer. We've had patients who've come off for side effects reasons after 2 months or 3 months. And, you know, remarkably, many of those have not recurred. So we just don't know how long. And I think the answer is going to be different for different patients. I mean, I think that although the responses are often quite quick, I've also had patients where it's taken longer and, you know, you may have stable disease at the first time point and then a little bit of regression and they don't hit partial response until a number of months later. So, you know, maybe patients who have these more stable disease or minor responses that take longer, maybe they need longer therapy, you know, so I don't entirely know the answer to that. Coming back to your question about pseudoprogression, that again, I think, is something that we probably see more of in melanoma than lung cancer. I mean, most patients, you know, it's pretty clear cut whether they're responding, but we definitely have patients who have what's called pseudoprogression. And I think the reason for that is either a delayed response for these drugs to work, or what you see radiologically may not represent tumor exclusively, and you may be increasing the component of T cells within an inflammation within that area. So what you're seeing is a composite of increasing T cells and tumor together. And so the actual tumor itself may be reduced in size, but that's not visualized because of the inflammatory component. And patients can develop new lesions that may not represent cancer. I had a patient last week who developed a new axillary node on therapy and had been responding previously, and we biopsied it, and it was all inflammatory cells. There was no cancer at all. So it's definitely something that needs to be considered when you see new lesions in patients who are clinically stable and improving in terms of their pain or breathing. If you see something new potentially popping up, I think it needs to be assessed by biopsy to make sure that, you know, you're not seeing pseudoprogression.
Can you talk a little bit about what the difference is between an anti-PD-1 agent and anti-PD-L1? And what we know or what you think about the relative efficacy and tolerability of these two strategies?
It's hard to compare the drugs. They're quite different. The PD-1 agents do inhibit PD-L1 and PD-L2, so it's possible that if PD-L2 is also an important inhibitory molecule, that could favor PD-1 agents. The data so far, if you look at, you know, all the different trials, I mean, the response rate in unselected patients seems fairly comparable. So I think it's really hard at this point to say whether a PD-1 drug is better than a PD-L1 or vice versa. I do think that there may be some less risk of pneumonitis with the PD-L1 inhibitors. It's seen in probably 2-3% of PD-1 lung cancer patients. It is much, much lower with the PD-L1 compounds. So I think that there's some differences, but I think that it's hard to say that I would choose one drug over another.
What about the pneumonitis in general? How often has it been seen? Have you seen any cases of it? And how is it managed?
Right. So I think pneumonitis is something that, you know, for people who are using these drugs, needs to kind of be on your mind all the time. I think that for patients who may be developing any increase in cough or shortness of breath, or maybe desaturating a little bit on their O2 saturation measures, you know, I have a pretty low threshold to get a non-contrast chest CT just to make sure that we're not dealing with pneumonitis. I think it's also important to note that if you do see some radiologic abnormalities, they do not need to be bilateral. Like, you know, we see typical drug toxicities with bilateral inflammation. And very often you may just see, you know, some patchy infiltrate in the left lower lobe or the right lower lobe. They don't need to be bilateral. I think the key is to act on those findings quickly, and usually it's with corticosteroids. For patients who are developing hypoxia, who are more sick, we typically would admit them for high-dose steroids. If it's more modest, a little bit of cough, O2 sat's okay, but you see some infiltrates, then I think we can manage that with outpatient steroids. By and large, we give a longer tapering course of therapy than we would for perhaps radiation pneumonitis or chemotherapy pneumonitis, because your T cells continue to be active even without therapy for a longer period of time. You know, we taper these patients very slowly and being very alert to recrudescence of pneumonitis when the drug is stopped. And by and large, we're fairly leery of retreating those patients who develop pneumonitis on therapy because of the risk.
So is this a clinical diagnosis or do you usually get tissue?
We often, you know, because we're trying to understand the pneumonitis, I think it's usually useful to try to do a bronchoscopy on these patients, you know, because they have lung cancer. It could be that there's some lymphogenic spread of disease that looks like cancer, and it's, you know, you want to know whether it's cancer, rule out any superimposed infection. So I think, though, that clinically we can do a pretty good job of distinguishing whether we think this is pneumonitis versus infection versus tumor. And I would say that if you think clinically this is pneumonitis, you don't want to delay starting steroid therapy to wait. You know, if it's a Friday and you're not going to get your bronchoscopy till Monday, then I wouldn't delay starting steroid therapy because it can accelerate fairly quickly.
So one other question, what other side effects and toxicity do you see? What do you see quality life-wise? Is it, you know, I think about monoclonal antibodies, and sometimes they're extremely non-toxic and other times they're very problematic. Just sort of globally, what do you see in these people?
Globally, the toxicities are really very low. You know, most patients don't feel that they're having any side effects and they question whether they're receiving active drug, even though they are. The toxicities that are most seen are possibly some pruritus, some rash, some myalgias, some fatigue. But typically for most patients, they're not compromising the patient's quality of life or their ADLs and really can be managed symptomatically without too much trouble. We do need to monitor these patients carefully for endocrine dysfunction in terms of their thyroid function tests, or if patients are developing any symptoms of adrenal insufficiency, you know, monitoring their ACTH and cortisol levels. Thyroid function abnormalities are not uncommon. Adrenal insufficiency is fairly uncommon, but I think you just have to be alert to these possibilities and introduce replacement thyroid hormone as needed. We don't really see much colitis and transaminitis like we do with CTLA-4, so those toxicities are something to be alert for, but they're not a common side effect.
So let's talk about clinical research available with these agents, beginning with nivolumab.
So really the longest data with nivolumab is, you know, the 03 phase 1 trial. And because of the activity that was seen initially, the lung cancer patients, there was an expansion cohort. A total of 129 lung cancer patients were treated with nivolumab. And we really have the longest term data with a 2-year survival in the 20% range, which is really compelling for this heavily pretreated patient population. In terms of data that's pending for nivolumab, a phase 2 squamous cell lung cancer trial in third-line therapy or greater for squamous cell lung cancer has been completed, and we're waiting for a readout on that data. The phase 3 trials have also been completed comparing nivolumab versus docetaxel as second-line therapy in one phase 3 trial in non-squamous histology, the other in squamous histology. And there's now an ongoing first-line trial with nivolumab versus chemotherapy in PD-L1 positive patients as first-line treatment. I think the good thing about that trial is that if you do are PD-L1 positive and you get randomized to chemotherapy, you are allowed to cross over to nivolumab if the chemotherapy stops working.
What do you know about response rate and progression-free survival with this drug?
I think that, you know, the response rates do seem to be tracking well with longer-term outcome in terms of PFS and overall survival. So I think the patients that do respond, by and large, those patients tend to have durable responses.
And if the drug were approved today, and of course it would depend a little bit on how it's approved, if it does get approved, how would you envision using it?
Well, I think whatever indication it's initially approved for, I think that there's no question that we would be very immediate adopters of that indication. I think that given the experience and really, I think, groundbreaking results with these drugs, I think this would be adopted fairly universally for its indication.
Would you want to use it first line if you could?
I think that if you are PD-L1 positive, then I think it would be totally appropriate first-line therapy. So I think that the other data that's in progress is with pembrolizumab and in their phase 1 trial, which was expanded to really hundreds of patients, there was a PD-L1 selection positivity with a low level of entry at a 1% expression of PD-L1, and their cutoff that they've defined based on analyzing the results of responders and long-term responders, you see a very good correlation with a 50% level of positivity by IHC and long-term benefit versus low-level expression or no expression. So I think that if the pembrolizumab comes to market, I think that if you have a 50% positive expression of PD-L1, then I think it would be appropriate for any line therapy.
Maybe we can talk about the anti-PD-L1 agents that are out there that you mentioned before and what data we have on these in lung cancer.
The data are a little bit more immature with the PD-L1 compounds. The trials were started a little bit later. We are seeing comparable sort of 15 to 20% response rate on selected patients. The response is enriched if you're PD-L1 positive. The MPDL-32808A is in phase 2 studies in PD-L1 positive patients, as well as randomized trials in unselected patients. And the MEDI-4736 trial is being studied in phase 2 PD-L1 positive patients, but also in randomized phase 3 trials. One of the interesting additional trials that's being conducted with MEDI-4736 is in the adjuvant setting after concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy for unresectable stage 3 disease. And trials with vaccines have shown a suggestion that there may be some benefit to immunotherapy post chemotherapy and radiation therapy. But for the reasons we talked about, that may not be the best immunotherapy. So I think it's really a great trial to give patients who are receiving definitive chemo and radiation therapy for stage 3 disease, and then patients are randomized to MEDI-4736 or placebo as an adjuvant treatment.
Yeah, I agree. It seems like a great population to target with the kind of poor prognosis that they have. I see also that at ASCO, you were part of an abstract looking at MEDI-4736 in combination with tremelimumab. What was the thinking there and what did you see?
We're very excited about the combination trials. I mean, I think that, we love the 15 to 20% response rate and durable response with single agent therapy. And we are excited about the PD-L1 biomarker selection to enhance for that response rate even further. But we want to know where to go next. How do we try to do better in these patients? And I think the first approach is to combine CTLA-4 with PD-1, PD-L1 with either the nivolumab and ipilimumab or the MEDI-4736 and tremelimumab. So I think that this is really our, I kind of think about immunotherapy, similar to where we were 30 years ago with cisplatin as a backbone therapy. And then, over the years, we've been able to kind of build on it and do better and better. But hopefully the benefits to adding therapy won't be incremental, but hopefully they'll be, bigger. And I think that as we understand the biology better, we can maybe try to learn about what to combine with PD-1 or PD-L1. Is it IDO? Is it CTLA-4? Is it LAG-3? Is it the list is growing in terms of potential combination immunotherapies and also combinations of immunotherapy with small molecules. We presented data combining erlotinib with nivolumab at ASCO as well and showed about a 20% durable response rate in these patients. And as I mentioned earlier, the never smokers don't respond as well. These are erlotinib patients with EGFR mutations. Are typically never smokers, but I think possibly the combination or possible upregulation of PD-L1 by erlotinib and acquired resistance may really be a patient population where, we can use these TKIs and antibodies in combination effectively.
So these were people progressing on EGFR TKIs on erlotinib?
20 of them had acquired resistance to erlotinib. There was one patient which was treatment naive that went on as well. But of the patients that were pre-treated, the response rate was about 20% if you count some patients who may have had some pseudoprogression.
What was the thinking in looking at patients with EGFR mutant disease? Were you thinking that might respond more, or what were you thinking?
I think that for these acquired resistance patients, you know, before the next generation TKIs, when we started this, there's limited options for these patients. And I think that we wanted to understand what the safety profile was and potential benefit was with the combination. And we were able to show we could safely combine erlotinib with nivolumab and that there was a subset of patients that had a durable benefit.
I guess if you think about it and that concept, a lot of which has come out of your place, so the idea of preventing a tumor flare.
Right.
And if you're starting out immunotherapy, so maybe they sort of don't have anything to do with each other, but clinically, you don't want to see the patient flare as you're about to start immunotherapy, I guess.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that that's a great point that, you know, one of the challenges with the acquired setting patient population, that transition from erlotinib to your trial can be tricky for that reason.
One other question before we move on. You know, there was a lot of excitement. There still is a lot of excitement, as you said, about squamous cell, given the lack of options. At this point, does it look like, you know, patients with squamous cell benefit more than non-squamous, or is it kind of about the same?
I mean, all the data that's coming out would really suggest that they're about the same. I think that the caveat to that would be that the never smokers with adenocarcinoma may be a subset that would respond less well. But I think if you compare kind of the smoker-related adenocarcinoma versus squamous, which are almost always have a prior history of smoking, they're coming out around the same.
So let's talk a little bit about RET fusion positive non-small cell. First of all, what is it? How often does it occur? What kind of clinical pathologic features is it associated with? And what kinds of treatment strategies are being looked at?
Right. So a few years back, there was a publication that demonstrated a RET fusion from Asia in a never smoker with lung cancer. And I think that RET, you know, is a fusion that is behaving similarly to other targeted type treatment options, such as EGFR mutations, ALK fusions, you know, ROS1 fusions. And, you know, at the time when we saw that RET fusion described, we embarked on a trial that we initiated with cabozantinib, which is, you know, multi-targeted agent, but RET is one of its target. And we clearly saw preliminary activity, which was very impressive, with cabozantinib and RET fusion lung cancer that we published in Cancer Discovery last year.
What fraction of patients have the RET fusion?
In unselected patients, it's probably in the 1% to 2% range. If you're a never smoker with lung cancer, it's going to be higher. It's probably about 5 or 6%.
So this is a driver mutation?
It does seem to be a driver oncogene, yes.
And is cabozantinib the only agent that's been looked at? Are there others that are more specific?
There are other compounds, but they're all similarly seem to be, you know, multi-targeted agents. So as far as I know, there is not a RET-specific targeted therapy.
And what do we know right now, and what's your best estimate of what the chance is that a patient will respond or benefit, for example, from cabozantinib with the RET fusion?
So far, you know, we've seen about 3/4 of the patients having good, durable responses.
So this is kind of a typical targeted situation. They mostly respond, good waterfall plots, and then they relapse?
Yes.
So have you been treating patients off study with cabozantinib who you found this RET fusion in?
We have in one case that I can think of who was not eligible for the trial for, you know, did not meet one of the inclusion criteria. You know, and they did have a response. But for the most part, it's been easier for us to have patients go in the trial rather than try to get the drug commercially. What other places that don't have a trial are doing, I think that there certainly is some interest in trying to obtain cabozantinib or vandetanib off trial. So I think that there is some of that going on.
Has vandetanib been looked at in lung cancer?
In unselected patients, yes, but in RET fusion positive, I think there was one case report of a response that was published last year.
I mean, it kind of sounds a little bit like about what I've been hearing in terms of BRAF inhibitors with BRAF mutations in lung cancer. I'm hearing people say it works and we're trying to get it and we are getting it. I don't know whether it's gotten quite that far with the RET fusion, but do you see that as where this is heading? Do you see people, you know, using, say, cabozantinib off study?
Well, I think giving targeted therapy for known oncogenic drivers is part of NCCN. And I think that if you have a patient with a RET fusion who doesn't have access to a trial, I think that that opportunity should be afforded to them.
So that leads into this poster that your group had at ASCO looking at next-gen sequencing. What kind of assay were you looking at here, and what exactly did you look at?
So we did that trial in conjunction with Foundation Medicine, and at the time it was around a 200-gene next-generation sequence platform. And the rationale that we had for doing this trial is that, you know, for patients who were never smokers, who, as you know, are more likely to have specific oncogenic drivers, you know, we wanted to know if they had some other driver that we were not able to detect by our standard platform of involving a combinations of sizing assays, sequenome, and FISH assays to look for EGFR, ALK, RET, and ROS1. So if we tested negative for all of those, then we wanted to see what the Foundation test could produce. And it was actually a very interesting result in that we were able to pick up drivers that were not detected by our standard testing. And I think that it wasn't that we were necessarily picking up a lot of new drivers, but we were picking up drivers that were negative, including EGFR, ALK, RET, and ROS1. Particularly the fusion seemed to be, you know, much better in terms of detection by next generation than the FISH assays. So we were able to identify patients that could get targeted therapy by next gen. And we've, at our institution as well, we've really transition to next-gen sequencing of 300-plus cancer genes as our standard institutional assay as well.
So, yeah, it looks like you reported 9 out of 25 patients identified, quote, an actionable mutation. But some of these I don't exactly recognize. EGFR G719A, EGFR L747P, these are what, unusual variations of EGFR mutations?
Right.
And do we know, like, do EGFR TKIs work?
One of them, yes. The other one, I'm not sure.
So where do you see next generation sequencing fitting into community practice? It is possible to order these tests. Should they be ordered up front the way they are done in tertiary centers? Should they be ordered in patients who've run out of all approved therapies, or should they not be ordered?
Well, the challenge is the timeline. You know, I think that to do next generation, you know, still requires about 3 weeks if you want to do a full 300 cancer gene panel. There are smaller platforms, but, you know, you really want to get definitive answers for all of the genes, including the fusions in particular. So I think that what we're doing is we are doing a more rapid assays to look for EGFR and ALK to get more real-time information, and then also in parallel doing next generation to get more complete data.